we fully understand that without your understanding and your support, that we are very hard pressed to meet our many missions. And as I speak of missions, it occurs to me that our primary mission and the primary mission of your committee are basically in mirror of each other, in that our main concern is protecting the public and public safety. Followed very closely by that is a concern that we have of running safe institutions for the benefit of our staff, contractors, volunteers, and inmates that are incarcerated in our institutions. We also have as a primary purpose to provide prison environments that are stable and are conducive to the successful running of transition programs that are part of the Oregon accountability model that Director Williams talked to you about quite a bit, and are designed to mitigate the risk of future criminality among the inmate population once they transition back into the community. Another one of our purposes is to deliver a professional quality, constitutionally mandated health care using an efficient managed care system in support of the mission of the Department of Corrections. Please turn to slide number 3, and you have before you an organizational chart that depicts all of the different components of the operations division. Within each one of the boxes in that chart, you will notice there are two sets of figures. One, the first set has to do with the number of positions that we have in each one of those respective areas. The second figure has to do with the full-time equivalent. The reason there's a difference between the number of positions and the number of full-time equivalent positions is that a number of our positions are part-time positions, and it takes several of those to equal a full-time equivalent. If you'll turn to slide number 5, I'd like to show you the location of all of the prisons that are located throughout the state of Oregon. And as you can see by this, very quickly, we are literally located north, south, east, and west in Oregon, in addition to being in the center of the state with some clustering around the Salem area. And there are a couple of locations on there that are projected areas for prisons, that being Junction City and White City. And in the very center of the state, you'll see the Deer Ridge Correctional Institution, which is not in operation yet, but which is due to come online, at least the first phase, in September of this year. Please turn to slide number 6. And you'll see a breakdown for the operations division. I'm just...
If I can interrupt you with a quick question. On page 4, where it breaks down the number of full-time equivalents in each institution, do you think you could give us a ballpark figure on the number of inmates in, say, 3 of those institutions, Deer Ridge, I don't know, SRCI and OSCI, as I guess the range?
Sure, we have Chair Shields. We do have that information here. I can give you a ballpark.
Ballpark will work.
Okay. I'll give
you want a ballpark?
Okay.
Go ahead,
Chair Shields. Here's a ballpark. The Snake River Correctional Institution is just short of 3,000 inmates. The Deer Ridge Correctional Institution, which is going to be phased in over the course of literally not only next biennium and the biennium after that, but won't actually be completed as far as phase-in wise until the biennium after that. At that point in time, we will have around 1,800 plus inmates. And what was the other one, Chair?
OSCI.
OSCI. OSCI has currently got about 800 inmates.
Great. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add, too, on page 30 of the presentation in the overview, there's a chart that has the number of beds, essentially, which roughly translates to the number of inmates in each of those facilities. And that's the overview portion of your presentation.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Williams. Please continue.
Okay. Chair Shields and members of the committee, the operations division is broken down into 5 separate units. The first being institutions, the second being health services, which is further broken down into medical services, dental care, mental health services, and pharmacy services. We also have a chief of security section and operations policy management unit, as well as an inmate work program. I'm going to tell you a little bit about each one of those. What I'd like to do is just kind of give you an overview of the division and then get into budget drivers and then talk about some cost-saving measures. And probably very rapidly go through key performance measures since Director Williams spent a lot of time on that on Monday, and then get into three policy option packages that we'd like to present before you. If you turn to slide 7, what you'll see before you is the institutions unit of the operations division. And this includes currently 13 institutions with one on the way, which would be 14 with the opening of Madras. As of February 2007, we have 13,400 inmates in the Department of Corrections. The Operations Institutions Unit is administered by the Administrator of Institutions, whose responsibility is to ensure that all of our institutions are run on a high level of care within current policies and procedures, and certainly statutes that apply to the running of prisons. When an inmate first comes to the Department of Corrections, their first stop is the intake center located at Coffee Creek Correctional Institution, and as a part of the initial assessment, they go through a whole series of assessments, the first being criminogenics, and I'm not going to get into that in any specific way, but other than to say that the criminogenics assessment really is an attempt to get to the heart of the reasons why inmates came to prison in the first place, the criminological factors that caused them to get into trouble with the law and come to prison. And I think that my colleague, Ginger Martin, who's the Director of Transition Services, will be talking quite a bit more about that. We also do a security classification, and that's to ensure that we don't have inmates who are deemed to be at high escape risks placed in institutions where it would be very easy for them to escape from. And the second thing is we want to make sure that those inmates are not placed in institutions where they have known enemies, so that has caused major problems in Department of Corrections throughout the country by way of even homicides and serious assaults and the like. And we also want to get a read as to whether the inmates are involved in a security threat group, which are commonly known as gangs. And that helps us to decide where we want to assign some of these inmates. In addition to that, we do a full medical history, thorough physical examination, and a dental examination. In addition, we do a mental health assessment, which includes an assessment of suicide risk, and we also want to know which inmates have developmental disabilities. Beyond that, we do a substance abuse screen on all inmates, and that is a major issue for us in that about 70%+ of our inmates do have substance abuse problems. We also do a full educational workup where that's indicated and a cognitive assessment. In addition to that, once all those assessments are done, we put together what we call a corrections plan. Each individual inmate has their own unique corrections plan to try to address the issues that were identified throughout that whole assessment that I just mentioned. And this plan is not a static, cast-in-stone document, but is continually under review and monitoring by our counselors and used as a personalized transition plan by transition counselors when the inmate is nearing his date of release. We believe that the careful application of the corrections plan by the Department of Corrections counselor over the length of the entire incarceration experience can contribute to successful transition back into the community and, importantly, reduce the risk of future criminal behavior. It's our hope that these strategies will ultimately make Oregon safer for its citizens. Please turn to slide 8, and I'd like to talk to you about the next unit in the operations division, and that is health services. Yes, Chair Shields.
Mr. Sarniaker, Mr. Williams, is the number of inmates that have a release plan, say within 30 or 60 days of when they enter the system, is that one of your KPMs?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the number of individuals who have a release plan within the 30 to 60 days of entering the systems is not a key performance measure. The Transitional Services Division does have some performance measures around release plans that are divisional performance measures, I think, that they monitor towards the end of the stay, but not necessarily at the beginning. So that's not something we're measuring, I think, at the front end. By and large, though, we do monitor and track fairly closely those individuals who have completed the whole battery of assessments that are done in intake. They're usually in that Coffee Creek facility for somewhere between probably 25 to 30 days as we're getting them through the various educational, mental health, medical, and the criminogenic assessments. And we do monitor that unit at intake does monitor occasions when people who are being moved out of that unit without the completion of those, so those things can be followed up on if they've had to be moved to another institution. So there is some tracking of that those tasks being accomplished. And we did for a while at least track and report back to the legislature and achieved a point where we were getting 100% of those criminogenic assessments being completed on all inmates entering the system. And I know that that's something that we monitored, and then at some point that became standard operating procedure, and I don't know that we're continuing to necessarily monitor it now because I think it happens as a matter of course.
The Oregon accountability model, just so I understand the terminology and how all these things fit together, and the committee does too, the notion is that somebody comes into the institution and that, you know, transition planning begins at day one, and that's what the battery tests are for, right? And from that, then you come up with that kind of a treatment plan, essentially, on how to best maximize their time away.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's a component of the Oregon accountability model. It's not the entire piece. The Oregon accountability model has a number of different components, including focuses on work and family. The whole reentry concept is sort of a separate piece, and also just the staff inmate interaction piece, that pro-social environment that we try to establish inside the institutions. But assessment and case planning is a component of the Oregon accountability model, and so we do make a big effort. As Mr. Zerdiak pointed out, the issues associated with the assessments aren't all designed specifically just to figure out the case plan. Those assessments also tell us what the custody level for classification purposes that this individual ought to be housed in, the medical issues that relate to what kind of institution they're going to need to be at to receive what their appropriate level of medical care. So those things also play a factor. So it does help us define the case plan and the trajectory of this individual while they're in the system, but not all of it is necessarily solely related to the issues of reentry and transition.
So if you can't say, 100 days the person's in, that each person has a plan that does A, B, C, and D, you don't have that kind of checklist necessarily.
Mr. Chairman, I think we could say at 100 days pretty much with maybe very rare exceptions. Everybody's been through the assessment process, so we know where everyone is with respect to all of these issues, and there's a case plan. And if it's if it's suggesting that people need educational interventions as well as perhaps alcohol and drug treatment or cognitive interventions, that those things have been generated actually once they've been sort of ranked on their risk scores. Those things are generated through an automated system that places them on waiting lists, essentially, to start lining them up for receiving those programs. So there is a checklist, essentially, that's done, and a great deal of that now is automated that sort of puts these people on those waiting lists, and as those slots become available and they work with their counselor and everything else lines up, hopefully they drop into those slots at the appropriate time.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. Chair Shields, members of the committee, I'm going to talk about the Operations Division Health Services Unit. The U.S. Constitution does not require that states have Department of Corrections, but they do require that if you're going to have a Department of Corrections, that you have to provide a community standard of care in health care, not only in health care, but also in mental health care. And this has been continually reinforced by the courts throughout our history, particularly much more so lately. And not providing appropriate health care and corrections can cause very expensive federal court interventions, and we've had a couple of those during our recent history. The health services must deliver a full spectrum of services that would include acute illness and injury, diagnostics, care for chronic diseases, work physicals, public health functions, nursing home care for those inmates who cannot care for themselves, and end-of-life care, such as a hospice program. And I think that you saw that program when you were at the penitentiary yesterday. And to the best of our ability, we try to provide all of our medical care, as much of our medical care as we possibly can, within one of our correctional facilities. It's much more cost-effective. It certainly is much safer in terms of public safety, which you can do the medical care inside of a facility rather than taking an individual out into the community. And it's also much cheaper from a security standpoint rather than having to take two officers out in the community with one inmate. It's much more preferable to do the service inside of the prison environment. However, there are times that we have to take inmates out into the community, and that's when we incur much higher costs and, again, more security involvement. But I think the point is about right now 99% of all of our medical encounters do occur on-site within one of our institutions. And to be able to do that, we currently have 5 infirmaries. You saw one of them yesterday. Located throughout the state for a total of 76 infirmary beds. We also have a medical unit at each institution, and what that means really is that some may be an 8-hour operation, some may be 24-hour operation, some may be 16 or somewhere in between that. And just to give you an idea of the scope of the number of on-site encounters that we have had so far this biennium, actually, this is over 2005. We haven't counted up all the numbers yet for 2006. But in 2005, our health services handled over 544,509 on-site medical and dental encounters with our MI population. Also, just as kind of an interesting figure for you, and I've got much more data we could share with you, but given the time what it is, we've cut this down. Over 90% of the inmates entering the Department of Corrections demonstrate some significant tooth decay, which requires us to provide the appropriate treatment. We also operate a centralized pharmacy and medical supply distribution system, which we have found to be much more effective and much more efficient than contracting those same kind of services out to private pharmacy firms. Give you an idea of pharmacy scope. We typically fill in a given month about 25,000 prescriptions, and this medication costs us about $8.5 million. About half of that cost goes to inmates that have mental health problems. And I'd like to give you kind of an example of what we've been able to do with our pharmacy in terms of buying medications, comparing that with what you would pay for the same medication on the open market, assuming you didn't have insurance. There's a drug called Combivar, which is used for HIV treatment. One tablet of that in the community would cost you $16.34. We get that same tablet for $10.88. There's another tablet that I'm sure you've all heard of called Lipitor for lowers cholesterol. That tablet out in the community would be $4.33. We get it for $3.21. And finally, there's another tablet called Filosec, which is used for gastric acidity. That tablet is 70 cents in the community. We get it for 54 cents. I'm going to discuss more aspects of the pharmacy when we get into budget drivers, but I'd like to move on now to mental health services. And first of all, I think stress that we focus our mental health services on those inmates who have the most need. Currently, as of December 2006, there were 3,630 individuals, or 27% of our inmate population, with some sort of mental health issues. 20% of all inmates are categorized as having severe mental health problems, and 7% are categorized as having moderately mental ill issues. I think the first time that Director Williams spoke to this group in January, a question came up about the rate of mental illness for female inmates, and I've got some data here for you on that. The need for female inmates is currently about 2.5 times the rate that it is for males. And as of 12/31/06, the mental health caseload for females was approximately 62%, 0.5% of the total adult female population in our prison system. 48.7% of those were categorized as being severely mentally ill. You toured the special management unit yesterday, and that those units are for those inmates whose mental illness prevents them from being able to function in a general open population without special care, and in the case of special management unit, actual special housing. We currently have SMUs in three institutions for a total of 82 special management unit beds, and I'll talk a little bit more about that as one of our budget drivers is to expand. I mean, one of our policy option packages is to expand the number of those beds. These beds are used for both crisis intervention and the delivery of long-term care. And in the long term, the Department of Corrections is currently evaluating the need for more mental health housing beds in future prisons, and we're also working with the Oregon State Hospital, the Psychiatric Review Board, the Oregon Youth Authority, and the Mental Health Division to develop a comprehensive long-range plan. The department facilitates a very wide variety and range of mental health and developmentally disabled programs, and this listing is really pretty extensive, and if you're interested in that, you can find it in your appendix. I'd like to talk just briefly about suicides. A very unfortunate circumstance in any prison system is whenever you have an inmate suicide. Unfortunately, in the year 2006, we did in the Oregon Department of Corrections have two inmate suicides. During that same period of time, we doubled our training for staff in service from 2 to 4 hours. And the main thing we teach during that training is the recognition of suicidal ideation in inmates and initiating appropriate responses to inmate self-harm attempts. We also do, as I mentioned earlier, a very in-depth suicide screening for all inmates coming into the Department of Corrections. And any time an inmate is placed in one of our special housing units, such as our intensive management unit or our disciplinary segregation unit, we immediately notify mental health so they can send a professional down to talk to the inmate and do a face-to-face assessment to see if there is a suicide potential in that circumstance. In addition, we provide specialized training for all staff who work in our DSUs, our disciplinary segregation unit, our ADSEG unit, our special management unit, and our intensive management unit. You probably noticed yesterday that the staff that worked in the special management unit all wore civilian clothes. Many of the staff that you saw there were certified correctional officers, and as part of the treatment, we try to normalize that environment by having them wear civilian clothes. Please turn to slide number 9. And I'd like to talk to you about the security unit. The security unit is broken down into several subunits. The first is inmate transport. And as the name suggests, it provides secure transport of inmates throughout the state for a number of variety of reasons. I'll give you an idea of how many miles we drive in that unit, and I'll give you a further idea of why we do that. During so far to date in this biennium, we've had 884,000 accident-free miles with our inmate transportation unit. And this unit has provided transport to over 40,000 inmates. And the types of trips that we take include court trips, hospital trips, specialist trips, and then also transfers for disciplinary reasons and transfers from one institution to another to be in accordance with the corrections plan. If there's a service that's not at the institution where the inmate is currently at and it's time for him to get that service, we may have to transfer him where that service is located.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Westland.
As we were leaving yesterday, we saw two transport vehicles come up and the weapons were checked outside. Are those your vehicles? Do you own those? Or
Mr. Chair,
they were white, unmarked.
Senator Westland, I'll jump in because I don't know that Mr. Zerniak was with us when we saw that.
By the way, could you please identify yourself, Chief?
Yeah, I'm sorry. For the record, Max Williams, Director of the Department of Corrections. The two transport vehicles we saw pull up were white four-door sedans, and those are typically used for You know, if you're taking someone, you know, out to a hospital visit or a court visit or something like that, that would be the kind of vehicle that would be used. Those sedans are likely under a lease agreement through the Department of Administrative Services motor pool. There are other transport vehicles that the department does own in some variety. An example would be the large buses that we do our major transports on from the east side to the west side that run on a fairly regular schedule. And then a variety of other vehicles in varying states and conditions. But most of what we drive that are of those type of vehicles, and even most of, I think, our vans, as I recall, yes, sure, are under an agreement through a lease program through the DAS motor pool.
And then follow up. Yes. Mr. Jerniak, you mentioned that you traveled 884,000 miles. Is that passenger miles or actually vehicle miles?
Chair Shields and Senator Westland, those would be actual miles.
Vehicle miles.
The vehicle miles, yes.
Do you have any idea how many passenger miles that would be?
Chair Shields, Senator Westland, I'm not really sure. I mean, we'd have to
be some
have to
multiple
figure that
of
out.
That.
Because some trips will have as many as 40-some inmates with a bus, and some will have just one going to an outside hospital, so that'd be an awful lot of figuring and calculating. But we
can I don't really need to know the answer. I just wanted a clarification that was actual miles. So you guys moving a lot of people, a lot of miles.
Yes, that's true.
Let's continue.
Also within the security unit, we have an institutional readiness section, and this section completes a in-depth, comprehensive security audit at all institutions to ensure that good security and good security standards and practices are being followed at all times. Again, in an effort to heighten security awareness and make sure that we're doing everything we can to keep our prisons safe and to protect the public. We also have 7 tactical emergency response teams that are armed teams, and they're specially trained to provide, to use force if necessary to maintain order within our institutions. We have crisis negotiation teams, which in some states are called hostage negotiation teams. And just to give you an example, we did have to mobilize a crisis negotiation team in April of 2005 when a female correctional officer was taken hostage at the penitentiary. Through the skill and hard work of this team, they were able to have the female officer freed without having to resort to using potentially lethal force from our tactical emergency response team. In addition, we have specially trained teams at every one of our prisons that are known as emergency support service teams. And these teams are on call to deal with staff that have been exposed to traumatic experiences within our institutions. A good example of that was a homicide that we had at the penitentiary in September of 2004, I believe it was. I think you're hearing about it in the press right now, the homicide trial that's currently going on. Several of our staff that were involved in the aftermath of that unfortunate experience were traumatized quite a bit and did receive benefit from our emergency support services teams. In addition, we maintain a very strong emergency preparedness program. We have found in this business that the worst time to test the readiness of your emergency response systems is when you have an actual emergency. So therefore, we set up simulated emergencies and scenarios, and we do this on a very regular basis. We have actually staff that judge how well we do on that, and then we spend some time debriefing and determining where we could have done better than what we did and where we did well. We also have an institution security staff deployment section, which has the primary responsibility of providing oversight for how we use our manpower resources throughout all the institutions. For example, and this is a bit extreme, but we want to make sure that we're not giving a lot of staff time off during hunting season so that we have to pay a lot of overtime to cover for them. And we want to make sure that every bit of relief that we have is used to its maximal capacity and effectiveness, again, to try to avoid overtime.
And finally, we have an inmate services section that deals with several issues, not all of which are constitutionally mandated, but some of which certainly are. And what they deal with is inmate visitation, inmate telephones, the performance recognition and award system. We have a non-cash incentive program that they manage. They deal with inmate grievances, and they also ensure that we meet constitutional standards when it comes to mandated inmate mail and legal library services. Up until 2 years ago, we used to have manual stacks of legal materials at all of our institutions. And you can imagine how much work that is to continue to update those stacks system-wide on a continual basis just to be able to provide the kind of materials that inmates may need to pursue some of their cases. We have since automated that entire process, so from one location, we can update all those stacks and send that out to all the various locations that we have. Please turn to slide 10.
Mr. Zernick, before you go on there, at the federal level, or the national level, I've seen from time to time citizen complaints about telephone companies gouging inmates and their families. And can you tell me a little bit about who the contractor is that we use for long-distance services and whether or not you think we have any of the problems that you hear about nationally?
I looked at Director Williams, Chair Shields, because this is a very this kind of in his radar screen right now.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, for the record, Max Williams, Director of the Department of Corrections. We do have a contract, and it was negotiated by the Department of Administrative Services with the statewide provider for all telephone systems, for all payphone systems throughout the state of Oregon that are under state contract. And I may be wrong about the contractor. I want to say it's Quest, but I believe it is. And that contract was negotiated a few years back. And we have been following this issue associated with the costs associated with inmate phone charges. Many of those issues are, a number of the issues that drive inmate phone charges are outside the control of the Department of Corrections, in the sense that there are things that I've learned about in this job now that are called service area LATAs. And if you're in one area and you call another area and you cross that LATA, there are certain charges that are applied that are really administered by the Public Utility Commission on how all of that operates. So at the current time, if you're an inmate in one of our more distant or remote facilities and your family lives in Portland, you're going to pay some disproportionate charge to call your family than if you were, say, living at or housed at Columbia River and you were calling your family somewhere in the Portland metropolitan area. It's the long-distance type charges. The other challenge associated with charges on inmate phones is that the companies that operate the systems, inmates will often call their families collect. And because of the ability to recover those collect call charges, most of the companies, the phone systems, not the ones that we contract with, but often the ones that are the people providing phone service on the receiving end of that call, will place a surcharge on a call going into a home on an inmate collect phone call. And that surcharge is essentially operates to some degree like an insurance policy. If they surcharge all the calls and they collect only a portion, then they kind of break even or at least make themselves whole is the argument. Again, an issue on the receiving end of that call that we don't have much to that we can control. What we did do a couple of years ago was move to a debit card system inside the institutions where inmates can actually take funds out of their inmate trust account and put it on a calling card type debit card and initiate that call from inside using the inmate phone system, initiate that call, and that's a much less expensive way to call their family, and it reduced substantially the overall charges. Some of the challenge with that is that that means that the inmate has to be spending their inmate welfare funds to make that phone call, and many of them choose not to do that and still opt to call their families collect where it's the more expensive type of the program. But that's been one of our approaches to try to address that. The department in the negotiated contract does receive financial return on the inmate phone system, and it's used essentially in two primary ways. The first way is we fund all of the inmate phone management out of the cost of those phone calls. So the provision of those phone booths and then the recording, because all inmate calls are recorded digitally, the recording and monitoring and the management of our telephony unit that does that is all taken out of the service charges associated with those phone calls. The second portion of the funds that come in, the great extent of them, are immediately turned back into the inmate welfare fund. So they go not necessarily to department operations, but to the inmate welfare fund. And the bulk of inmate welfare fund charges are used to fund alcohol and drug treatment type programs throughout the system. So in a way, those funds off of those charges are being turned back around as we get the funds back in from the contractor and are turned back into inmate program monies. One of the concerns I've had for a couple of years, and we're not at the end of this contract period, is the discrepancy in the charges that inmates have to pay depending on what institution you're at. Something they don't control, and we do. And I am concerned about the disproportionate impact that can have to inmates in some of these rural locations. And so we're reviewing a number of different options over time to talk about how we could equalize those charges among the inmate population. But one of our challenges is, because of the reduction in program monies over the years, we have become somewhat reliant on the payment out of those contracts for inmate welfare fund monies to feed the alcohol and drug treatment program dollars that don't exist and aren't funded through the general fund portion of the budget. So there's that bit of that Hobson's choice issue that we've been struggling with. But that kind of, I think, brings you up to speed. It is an issue that's under considerable review, and we've been working on Mr. Koreski, who is our General Services Administrator, Assistant Director, has telephony as one of the issues in the General Services Division that he's responsible for. So it's probably a much longer answer than you wanted, but I think it gives you a kind of a picture of the issues we've been trying to address it.
Yeah, no, I'm glad that you're paying close attention to it, and we needed that level of detail to be assured that that is happening, because even with the debit card, whether or not they decide to use it, I think it is at least helpful to have that choice, that they're not laying all that burden on their family and putting the family in a position where they have to say, no, I'm not going to accept your collected call.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to belabor this too much longer, but I also appreciate the response, and also it elicited some information that I hadn't really figured out from the presentation yet, which is that money goes back into then some alcohol and drug treatment programming that wouldn't otherwise go there. So that was very interesting to find out through the answer. But my one other follow-up, which I hope this is extremely brief, given that there are certain inmate mail is subject to certain rules and guidelines and so forth. If a family were to send a prepaid calling card to an inmate, would that be allowed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, I don't believe that it would. The phone system and the contract, the way it works is it's an exclusive franchise with the contractor to provide those services. And there's a lot of security around. We are constantly monitoring and ensuring that inmates don't have the ability, they have to identify even the list of numbers that they can call out to, and they can put quite a number of people on those numbers, but there is a limitation, and those numbers then have to be sort of cross-checked to ensure that it's appropriate. And one of the concerns, even with telephone technology that we've had, is in the days now of three-way calling, you can call forward, and there's all sorts of technical issues associated with that, and that's why the system has to be, and even with that, there are some limitations, but it has to be fairly well contained through a set, kind of a single source provider.
Thank you.
And Chair Shields and Representative Nathanson, if I could just add to that, the calling cards, I think, would quickly become currency in our institutions and would be used for probably some pretty illicit purposes. And also, we'd be concerned about the pressuring one inmate, pressuring another inmate out of their calling card, and being able to use it and that kind of thing.
Mr. Williams, so I understand correctly the kind of the disproportionate impact for people who are incarcerated in rural areas. That could be something that could be dealt with by the PUC if it chose to do so.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe that the answer to that is that it could be lessened potentially. I think it's a combination of both the way the contract operates and the way the public utility regulation for telephone calls in those LATA service areas operates. I think it's those two things in tandem that have an impact on that disproportionate cost. And as I said, I think the calling card, the debit card concept, helped to some degree, but there still remains a disproportionate cost for inmates and their families if they're calling across those LATAs. And up until now, we haven't struck yet, I think, what in our own mind is the right methodology to try to build this sort of a uniform cost associated with no matter where you're at, calling your family is going to be at a certain rate. The challenge with that is we can probably get there. It would mean lowering the rates for people who are in those far-flung, more rural institutions, but it might mean actually raising the rates for people who are here in the valley to some degree to sort of set that balancer off. And, you know, that's always, you know, again, sort of a options choice sort of solution. So we're working through it, and we hope by the time that we've kind of maybe move through the end of this contract period, we'll have some better ideas about how we want to move forward.
And if you have any suggestions on how we can help with that legislatively, feel free to bring them forward.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Cameron.
Yeah, probably a follow-up to a little bit that just struck me. I think yesterday in the tour we talked about their TV, or somebody brought up the TV and the cable. Can you explain how that utility is provided for the inmates? And we're talking about telephone.
Sure.
Chair Shields and Representative Cameron, yes, I can do that. We do have a cable contract at some institutions, other institutions, because of their location, we have a satellite contract. All that money is paid for through the Inmate Welfare Fund, which is, again, supported through canteen purchases and through the phone commissions.
Thank you.
And just a quick follow-up again, Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron. Inmates have to both earn the right through their conduct and then have to use their own resources for the purchase of television. So that's something that's available on the canteen but isn't provided to them. They have to have the resources to be able to do that themselves.
And I'll just add to that also, Chair Shields and committee, in addition to that, they have to exhibit clear conduct for, I believe it's 18 months before they can purchase a TV. There is an incentive, there is a non-cash incentive program that prescribes good behavior, and as you behave over successively longer periods of time, you can have more privileges. Getting back to the Operations and Policy Management Unit, that is a one-person operation, which this time during the session is very, very busy. One of their main responsibilities is legislative support, helped us put together this presentation. And they're also...
And one person for that? I need a team of 10 with the questions we have. Go ahead. Well, sorry.
I'll resist.
Also very much involved in ensuring that we have oversight over the budget spending patterns at all of our institutions, that we have ongoing policy development that keeps abreast of some of the court cases and some of the new laws that come out to make sure that our policies are in line with those. And also we have a number of projects that this position monitors and manages and makes sure that we're on track with. If you would turn to slide number 11, I'd like to talk to you about the Inmate Work Program. And this program literally oversees compliance with the Prison Reform and Inmate Work Act of 1994, which is commonly referred to as Measure 17. All eligible inmates are required to work or be in program assignments 40 hours per week, as you know. In addition to inmate work assignments within institutions, we have a number of inmate assignments outside into the community. And I'd like to talk to you a little bit about some of those. Currently, just to give you an idea of how many different types of projects that we are involved in with the inmate population right now, in addition to working with two federal agencies, the U.S. Forest Service and the U.S. Wildlife Service, we're also involved with 73 public and 17 state agency partners. These would include fire departments, Department of Transportation, DAS, and the military department. And in addition, we also work with 36 private and nonprofit agencies and over 112 community service partnerships throughout the state. And that would include such organizations as the Oregon Food Bank, Red Cross, Little Leagues, Lions and Elks Clubs, county fairgrounds, libraries, museums, and senior centers, etc. The Deschutes Mobile Camp is implemented and activated twice a year, usually early summer and then late fall, and they carry out fuel reduction activities in the federal forest, especially in very strategic areas, to make it much more easy to contain a forest fire should it start in those areas. And their efforts have received two fairly significant and prestigious awards, the first being in 2001. We received a Carrying of the Land Award, which was presented by the Department, the Oregon Department of Forestry and the Deschutes National Forest. In July of 2002, we received the Special Honor Award from the Secretaries of the United States Departments of Agriculture and the Interior. In addition, we have provided as many, especially this last fire season, as many as 210 inmate-trained firefighters to help fight fires throughout the state of Oregon. And an additional 100 inmates have been sent to provide camp and food services support for active firefighters that are on the fire lines. In addition to that, several of our institutions make sack lunches during the fire season that are, again, sent out to the fire lines. We also have a parks and prisons program, and to that extent we maintain or provide special projects to 24 parks statewide. If you had to take a typical day and figure out how many inmates are usually out there working somewhere in the state of Oregon providing some sort of community service, that number would be about 839 minimum custody inmates throughout the state. Please turn to slide 12.
Mr. Zerniak, before you go on, I just wanted to make sure that the committee knew the difference between what your operations are when it comes to inmate work programs and what Inside Oregon Enterprises is and the relationship. That's not going to be, they're not presenting, they're quasi-independent entities, so maybe you can just inform the committee on how that works, talk about any auditing you might do to make sure that those quasi-public dollars are used well.
Okay, Chair Shields and committee. The Oregon Correctional Enterprises is a semi-government agency. It's not really directly under the control of the Department of Corrections, and they do have contracts with some private vendors to provide work. I assume they're still part of the Prison Industries Enhancement Program, which is commonly referred to as a PIE program. The inmate work crews that I'm speaking of work strictly out in the community and do community-type projects, and they're not actually manufacturing anything, as would be the case of the Oregon Corrections Enterprises.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Max Williams again for the record. I just also point out these are the OCE, Oregon Correctional Enterprises, again was a creature of legislative referral out to the voters to sort of remove prison industries from underneath the Department of Corrections and outside of and to take it out of being funded in any way by the general fund budget. So it operates independently. They do operate, for example, as you on a tour of the penitentiary, although we didn't make it back there, those industries areas, the furniture factory, the laundry, the metal shop, those are OCE-operated shops. So they operate inside the walls of not only the penitentiary but other facilities around the state. They do employ inmates about 1,100 or so of the total 13,000 population. So a little less than 10% of the inmate population is employed by OCE. OCE has to be a self-sustaining organization, which means that they can't rely on any Department of Corrections funding or general fund dollars to help sustain them. So the products and services that they provide through partnerships not only with private but also public agencies, call centers, for example, through Secretary of State's office or DHS or others, ODOT providing certain information to citizens as they call. That's an example. The GIS mapping program at OSCI, where counties or other entities who need various technical work done on GIS mapping, those kinds of services, those contracts have to essentially fund the OCE operations. Similar, Furniture Factory creates furniture not only for things like the DPSST facility that I know you've had an opportunity to visit, but they also do dorm furniture for the university system and other public entities, public purpose sorts of construction. So that's the example of the work that they do. They're very good about a skills training sort of a component. The best example of that, I think, is recently at OSCI, they operate a print shop that prints a substantial amount of state material. So I think the odds are pretty, in fact, I'd almost guarantee you that any of your personal notes or business cards or any of those kinds of items came from OCE, from the print shop operated inside OSCI. And in that program, they have a skills program where they're actually certifying these people as they go through a process, and they've worked with the local printers around the state. So when these people release, there's a skill set that's been prepared by an advisory committee. They know what these people can do when they release out to move them towards becoming a journeyman printer through that experience. So, and we're attempting to do those same kinds of skill programs, skill building programs at most of the OCE operations. But it does create a little bit of, I think it's often that people don't recognize the relationship differences. The primary connection we have to OCE is the director of the Department of Correction. I appoint the administrator of OCE. But beyond that, the books are kept separate. OCE is audited. It's both subject to both Secretary of State, and they do an annual financial audit from an independent CPA firm, and that information is obviously publicly available.
And you can also fire that person?
The head of the OCE administrator? Yes, I can. I can appoint them, and I can unappoint them.
Unappoint them, yes. Well, Representative Barker.
Mr. Rums, just a, I don't know, this is a little bit off topic, but so these people have these job skills, and they go out. And one time I talked to somebody, and they said, well, the problem with that is they don't like those jobs when they get out because it's like too much like doing time to them. It reminds them too much of being back inside. Do you have any experience with that? I mean, you know, could you tell me, is that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, I don't really have any experience with that. I think most of the time the offenders who are working in jobs like the metal shop or the print shop generally are really pleased with the experiences that they've learned. And in my experience of just talking to inmates as I've walked through and asking them the kind of questions about what do you want to do when you get out, most of them want to take advantage of the skill set they've developed while they've been inside. The challenge is that it's tough to get a job with a felony on your record these days, and that becomes the primary barrier to entry when these people move back into the community.
Thank you.
And to that point, Rob Kilgore is the director, correct?
Yes, Rob Kilgore, Mr. Chairman, is the administrator of Oregon Correctional Enterprises.
He's looking at ways to draw what's going on the inside to what's going on the outside. And I suggested he try to find community-based organizations to, you know, potentially contract with to help with that kind of job placement. I think he's looking into that.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Great. Let's continue.
Okay, Chair Shields and members of the committee, if you'll turn to slide 12, you'll see a depiction, a pie chart, that shows how the governor's recommended budget is broken down. If you look at the left of that, you'll notice that the operations division takes the bulk of the share of that with 56.9% of the dollars. If you'll go to the right pie chart, you'll see that position-wise, we're quite a bit higher than that with 77% of the positions. It's times like this I wish I had brought my reading glasses. If you'll turn to slide number 13, I'll show you how the operations division itself is broken down dollars-wise. And again, as no surprise, the institutions section of the operations division takes up 77.3% of that total pie. And if you look at FTE, it's 84.6% of that slice. If you turn to slide 14, you'll see a chart I think is very similar to one that Director Williams showed you on Monday, and that is a continually growing cost of doing business as far as managing prisons goes. We're going to talk about what some of those budget drivers are in just a minute if you turn to page 15.
And I'm going to break the budget drivers down into, again, institutions operations and health services operations. And I'll start with institutions. The first thing, the first budget driver on the list for institutions has to do with, I'm sorry, if you'll turn to, well, let me just start out with the first budget driver for actually both has to do with labor costs. Labor is certainly a major driver for the operations division. The pie chart relating to agency staffing outlines that the operations division accounts for almost 88% of the agency's FTE. In 2005-2007, negotiated salary increases will certainly affect the operations division budget. Director Williams mentioned these costs in his opening comments to the committee on Monday. If you'll turn to slide number 16, we'll talk about the increasing population as a budget driver, and that's been consistently the situation we find have found ourselves in for several bienniums. By July 2009, our inmate count will go up another 780 inmates to a total of 14,180 in all. Using the current calculated cost of $67.53 per day or $24,648 per year per inmate, the department will spend an additional nearly $20 million per year on these inmates by July 2009. The largest budget item relating to the increasing number of inmates is the phased-in opening of the Deer Ridge Correctional Institution. Deer Ridge Correctional Institution, as I mentioned earlier, is slated to have a phased-in occupancy that will begin in September of this year with the opening of the minimum unit, which will have 428 beds. Of those 428 beds, 212 of those beds will be devoted to mental health programs. In addition, several months later, in February of 2008, approximately a year from now, we'll be opening up an additional 575 beds, which will include a mental health step-down unit, a medical movement restriction geriatric unit of 53 beds and 128 high custody disciplinary beds.
Excuse me, Mr. Sir. Are those numbers in your presentation somewhere?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Max Williams again for the record. If I could just reference you a chart that I think we gave you on the Monday of our presentation.
Supplemental?
I think it came separately during the Monday part of the presentation. This chart gives you essentially a breakdown of the individual units as well as the date that those units are anticipated currently under the current population management plan for when they would come online. And if you just note the 432 bed units are the 453 bed treatment related units, or I'm sorry, the 212 on the right side are the 453 bed treatment related units for AMC and mental health. You see them reflected there. Then you can see, as Mr. Zerniak talked about, mental health transition units and then other dormitory units. And then across the bottom is the medium facility. And although this isn't the physical layout of these units at the institution, they're done in sort of, they scroll across in the order in which those units come online by date. So it gives you a bit of a sense of how the units at Deer Ridge sort of stage on over a period of time.
Okay, so just so I understand this, these will be coming online this year. Is that what 513 means?
Mr. Chairman, 513 would be that unit would come on in May of 2013.
Okay, wow.
So the date is the month and the year. So the earliest units that are going to come on, you'll notice that 907 unit up in the right-hand corner, that's a 108-bed general population dorm. Those inmates will come over, and that will be the first unit we open, and that unit will be used
the inmate labor in that unit will be used to help prepare for the opening of the rest of the institution. They'll do a lot of, they'll assist with a lot of the equipment install and the grounds work, and that's been a pretty traditional model for the department as we've co-located these institutions with minimum and medium facilities to bring in minimum inmates to do work essentially as part of their responsibilities in helping us get to the point of opening the rest of the institution. And then you can see the dates as they move forward. Those treatment units come on in 11 of 07 as those 212 units come on. And of course, all of this assumes approval of the budget as it's currently laid out before you.
I think I got that. Thank you.
Okay. Chair Shields and committee, if you'll turn to slide 18, I'd like to talk to you about another significant budget driver, and that has to do with overtime. Whenever you have a large operation that is a 24-hour per day, 365-day per year operation, overtime is unfortunately inevitable and necessary to ensure continuity of essential functions and the safe and secure running of our institutions. Overtime is driven by several drivers. The first are vacancies. We have some parts of the state where it's more difficult to recruit and retrain qualified staff than it is to retain qualified staff than it is in others. Particularly that would be true in Pendleton and Ontario. Although I can tell you this, that our overall turnover rate for security staff is about 80%, so it's certainly not outlandish. The other...
thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to be sure I understood. Did you say 8%?
Chair Shields and Representative Nathanson, that is correct. That was the figure I was given by HR.
Short follow-up? That's very low. I've been hearing numbers from other agencies and other programs where it's, much higher, multiples of that, many times higher.
Chair Shields and Representative Nathanson, in some of our job categories, it is much higher than that. Nurses, for example, and particularly nurses.
Just so I understand that statistic and ensuring that we're comparing that correctly across agencies, are you suggesting that 8% of your staff will leave in a year's time? Is that what that means?
I'm sorry, Churchill. I didn't understand the question.
Does the 8% mean that you have 8% turnover within a year's time, or 8% of what exactly?
That's correct, Churchill. In a year's time.
And have you tell me about the turnover at Warner Creek? I assume it's difficult to get people staffed up there as well.
Chair Shields, our experience with Warner Creek was kind of interesting. We had a lot of staff initially that wanted to go there. It seemed like kind of an exciting place to be, the highest city in the state of Oregon. And a lot of people, you know, if you're into hunting and fishing and all that, there's a lot of that there, a lot of the winter sports. I think we did have, and I don't know the number or the percentage, we did have a number of staff that after spending one winter there decided they wanted to be somewhere else in the state. And I'm not quite sure that we have a huge problem. I mean, I don't believe we have a huge problem with vacancies there, but we did have some turnover a little bit higher than normal during the first year of operation.
And that's the one in Lakeview?
Right, Lakeview.
That's correct. Sure,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Kemmerer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I assume your HR department analyzes this stuff to the nth degree and looks at turnover in a particular institution, and I guess my question is do you have the ability to, through the bargaining to do different things in different locations with salary levels or incentives to get people to go there or to stay there?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Max Williams for the record. Really, the answer is no. There are certain institutional things that are bargained for regarding how shifts work or things like that that may be institution specific because of the layout of the format of the institution. But by and large, issues involving salary, there are two units that represent the security side of, or two labor unions that represent security officers inside the Department of Corrections. AFSCME is one of the units, and AOCE is another one. Those contracts are negotiated separately with each of those unions. But essentially, if you're a member of one of those unions, regardless of the institution you worked at, you're going to get paid the same. So a correctional officer working in Salem is going to get, who's maybe a 3 or 4 or 5 year veteran of the department, is going to be getting the same salary as a correctional officer in Ontario who's a 3 to 5 year veteran of the department, if they're both working for the same union and the negotiations have been the same. And the salary levels are pretty close in both of those labor organizations. So there isn't a lot of flexibility institution to institution as to how to deal with recruitment. And that is one of the challenges that we have as we're going through the process of hiring. And Mr. Zerniak was good to point out, I think, that there is always a vacancy issue that we're continuing to address around the state, and we monitor it pretty closely. And when we see an institution starting to have a greater than normal level of vacancies, it begins to drive overtime and other factors, a lot of attention is paid to that institution on how to help bring that down, whether it's extra people to help participate in various job fairs or all sorts of different things we do to try to recruit in that process. But really the area where we often are struggling is in the more industry-specific kinds of hiring. So hiring a pharmacist or to work in Ontario, or a nurse practitioner, or a dentist, or somebody in those health career categories, or maybe somebody who is really good at IT issues, or somebody who is a machinist. I mean, those specialty categories become even more challenging to recruit for in some of our remote areas. So that gives you a bit of a sense. I know that Ms. Honeywell, who's our Assistant Director of Human Resources, I think plans to talk a little bit about recruitment and classification issues during her presentation later next week.
Or the week after.
Next week. We're confident it'll be next week.
I'll be quiet.
and maybe that would be, I should ask this of her, but do you do exit polls? Because I would think some, like the hunters and fishermen would love being down there, but their wives might be saying, I'm not spending another winter up here, or husband.
Chair Shields, Representative Barker. Part of the problem, too, is besides that, is just the limited housing there. That has caused a problem. And there are some cases where we paid premium prices to get the housing that was available. And I think that may have caused some people not to locate there or to not stay very long.
And we don't have any prison housing. Employees anymore.
Chair Shields and Representative Barker, no, we don't.
Thank you.
The other very large overtime driver is sick leave. Prisons are clearly very stressful environments. Studies have been done in the past that have shown that if you spend a good part of your career in a prison environment, your average age is about average lifespan is going to be about 59 years old. So we do see, I think, fairly large amounts of sick leave, largely, I think, attributed to stress.
We try not to advertise that on the recruiting poster, by the way. talking about recruitment. So.
That's true.
Now you advertise the union wages.
Yes. Another budget driver as far as leave goes is that as the number of our staff get in higher seniority, they also start to accrue higher levels of leave, and as to be expected, they'd like to be able to use that leave on a pretty regular basis. The other issue for us is that within 90 days of hiring a correctional officer, we have to have them attend the Department of Public Safety and Standards Training Academy, which is a five-week program.
We've got the best trained
correctional officers in the world. Training program. And while they're gone at training, we typically have to rely very heavily on overtime to cover for them, to cover for their absences.
And in addition, we have specialized training that really is not covered by our funded relief factor. And some of that training involves some of the specialty teams that I talked about earlier. And in addition, we currently are providing training to staff around the Prison Rape Elimination Act. I'll talk a little bit about that on slide 18. The National Prison Rape Elimination Act was passed by the United States Congress in 2003. The act simply states that correctional agencies, whether they be federal, state, or local, will adopt whatever changes to architecture or practices necessary to eliminate prison rape. Part of our response to the requirements of the Prison Rape Elimination Act is to form at each institution sexual assault response teams. And these teams consist of members from mental health, from medical, and from security, who, when there is a allegation of rape or at least some indication that a rape may have occurred, they immediately start to interview whatever witnesses are available, conduct an investigation on their own, and to provide some support of the alleged victim. Although this is not a huge driver, it certainly does have some impact in causing additional training requirements that we're not funded for. One of the major budget drivers has been military deployments. Since 9/11 and the situations in Afghanistan and in Iraq, we have had to deploy ever larger numbers of our National Guard staff and United States Army Forces Reserve staff to one of those locations. Currently, we've got 24 staff that are so deployed. And just to give you some idea what that does to us impact-wise, that 24 staff that are deployed will cause an estimated overtime cost from July of 2005 until January of 2007 of about $635,000 in overtime costs. And the final thing I'd like to mention as far as an overtime driver goes, in one of the realities of prison life is that you will have incidents. Incidents can range from hostage situations to minor disturbances to arsons to just a host of different kind of activities. And when that does occur, although it's not that frequent in our system, but when it does occur, we found it prudent to have additional staff on duty to ensure that our institutions are run safely and securely. Well, when you're down to staffing at levels that are kind of, I won't say bare bones, but staffing levels that are at a minimal level to ensure safety and security, when you have to bring additional staff, and you usually do that by paying overtime. And so that can drive our costs up also. To give you some idea, since 1996...
Representative
Mr. Cerniak, you mentioned it was over $600,000 for 24 people in 2 years?
That's correct.
So are we assuming that every one of those that's deployed, we have to fill their position with somebody on overtime versus new people that we could hire in? And maybe I'm just off here. I mean, when somebody says I'm going on deployment, we don't recruit and try to hire for that position while they're gone?
Chair Shields and Representative Cameron, that is a very good question. We do try to do temp hires for those individuals because we do have to save the permanent position for the individual who's coming back into that job. We do try to do that, but it's very, very difficult to get very many people that really want to do that, and it doesn't really fill the gap that well.
Mr. Chair, if I could expand on that just a little bit again for the record, Max Williams, Director of the Department. We have an obligation to hold that position open for that individual when they return from their deployment, and they're entitled to go back right into the level of seniority and the bid cycle and everything else, so they're not in any way
negatively affected by the fact that they fulfilled their obligation to the National Guard. And we really try very hard to make sure that when these people are coming back, we're doing everything we can to sustain and support them and their families as they return back to active service. I think we've had, Mr. Cherniak referenced the 24 or so we've had out now. I think we've had over 100 in the last few years that have actually been serving on military deployment long-term in both Iraq and Afghanistan and other units where they've been operated on. We can't treat that job as if it's been someone who has terminated their employment. So from an FTE sort of a position, we have to keep that spot open, and we can't go out and hire beyond essentially our position authority to fill that spot. Because when they came back, we'd owe the obligation of the individual we hired to replace them, who we've now hired as a full-time employee, and would also then owe the obligation to give this person their position back. We manage a lot of vacancies, obviously, and so as we're hiring people, we're constantly trying to put people on permanent, but it's difficult to fill these positions with a temporary employee when we're hiring and trying to hire for so many permanent vacancies. If you've got the option of working for the department as a temporary employee with a limited degree of benefits or coming out permanent, you're going to take the permanent spot. And so we're enough behind in filling our vacancy load for permanent positions, but it's hard to fill these temp positions in a way, which means that that slot that's open then in the management of the institution is typically made up by having people work overtime. And I hope that sort of explains the complex. There's a lot of reasons why somebody might not come into work on any given day, and they fall into a variety of categories that then is being managed to try to fill those spots. And so whether overtime is being pulled that day for that particular slot, or whether it's overtime because the person who you would assign to normally work that spot had to call in sick that day, ultimately it has that kind of ripple effect through the entire system. Did that make much sense? The HR people could do a much better job answering that question than me. But
no, your explanation makes sense, but the system doesn't make sense. We can talk about it another time.
Okay, good.
I mean, if we have people gone for 2 years and we have a need out here, seems like a good training ground to bring people on to move them forward. But I understand what you're saying. Would I take this temporary job knowing that there's a full-time job? Well, if I'm working for the same organization, hopefully if I did a good job in this temporary job, when that person comes back, I can move on to the openings that are coming. But it's a whole other issue.
Sure, and we'll look actually for the opportunity maybe before HR presents next week to maybe have our HR person sit down. We can talk a little bit about this issue offline.
Could you also have the HR person discuss your employee assistance program? Because, you know, I know it's a very stressful job, and mm-hmm. corrections officers are at higher risk for substance abuse because of kind of the stress that's similar to a police officer, and I think that's going to be even more relevant to returning vets. So
we'd be happy to.
Okay. Please continue in the 5 minutes that you have left.
Okay. Chair Fields, just to give you an idea of how many times we've had to activate an emergency response team in our recent history, since 1996, our tactical emergency response teams have been activated a total of 26 times in response to events ranging from hostage situations, immediate disturbances, and the like. In the last 2 years, we've activated our tactical emergency response teams 5 times, and one had to do, again, with a hostage situation, 2 inmate disturbances, and we had 2 situations where inmates had weapons, and we felt we needed to activate the teams to get the weapons away safely.
That seems like a very reasonable and low rate. Do you have any sense of how that compares to other states?
Chair Shields, I would have to take a guess. Even though I have personally worked in other states, I would say it's very low comparatively.
Please continue.
Please turn to slide 19. Now that I've talked about some of the budget drivers, I would like to mention some of the cost control measures that we put in place to try to address and minimize the impact of some of those drivers. Several years ago, we did a statewide study, an assessment of what we felt what it would take to manage our prisons in a secure and safe fashion, and do that at kind of a minimal level, certainly not a bare bones level, but a minimal level, so that try to establish a level that we would never want to go below.
to be able to ensure a safe institution. We spend a lot of time paying attention to those staffing standards and ensuring that all of our institutions are, in fact, in compliance with them, unless, again, there's an unusual circumstance, like I mentioned, with some inmate unrest. Please turn to slide 19. I can get into some of the health service budget drivers, and some of those drivers are very similar to what you'll find in the institution side of the house.
Are you on 19 or 20?
20, I think.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry, 20. I read the top of the next slide.
And I think what we'll do is you can go through the slide on 20, and then we might break for the day, and unfortunately we'll probably need you to come back. We're very interested in the topic.
The first thing that I think is important for everyone to understand as far as the budget drivers for medical goes, that patients' medical and mental health statuses drives the need for care. The status of each inmate's health and dental health or illness determines that individual's ongoing need for health. So we take whatever comes to us and whatever ailments that those inmates bring with them, then we are obligated to treat. Health care also is interesting. I think that Director Williams noted this during one of his presentations. Healthcare needs for inmates are compounded by factors related to an inmate's prior lifestyle, typical inmate's prior lifestyle prior to incarceration. And this would be characterized by such things as substance abuse, which is very high in the department for inmates that come into the Department of Corrections, poor diets, in many cases antisocial behaviors, and probably most significantly lack of regular medical and dental care. As a result of this, many of our inmates have medical ages that are much older than their chronological ages, and that brings with them more severe diseases and conditions that we have to treat. And that would conclude that slide, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Any other closing comments before we come back tomorrow? Questions?
We're running up their budget. We have time and a half to replace them.
Mr. Chairman, at the pace we're going, I'm hopeful that we'll be able to complete Mr. Zerniak tomorrow and bring on the first part of Ms. Martin's presentation at the end of the week. And then I understand on Monday we'll break from the department's presentation, if that's correct. I think the day the lease has been currently identified for public testimony, and then we'll be back on to complete Ms. Martin's presentation on community corrections on Tuesday, and then hopefully the final divisions Wednesday and Thursday.
I would suggest that Ms. Martin be available on Monday in case there is not a full hour and a half of public testimony.
We'll be ready.
And then tomorrow there's also a federal grant.
Right.
And she'll need to get through the process here.
And she'll be prepared to speak about that tomorrow. If it's with the chair's approval, Mr. Wilson, we thought we would start with the federal grant conversation when she gets up first, her first opportunity.
Right. And colleagues, Ed Latessa from the University of Cincinnati will be here March 12th, one of the premier experts on what is affecting the correctional program. As always, if you have other people that you would like to have present as expert witnesses and testimony, just let me consider it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
This meeting is adjourned.